Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speakers will be William E. Ramsey and Betty Deneen Schreier, authors of Doorway to Freedom, The Story of David Kaufman. Mr. Kaufman was a German immigrant who lived in Grand Island and became a prosperous merchant and benefactor. This new book tells about his humanitarian efforts to save his fellow Jews from the Nazis during World War II. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 18, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Dale Munson, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Our two presenters today are really no strangers to our press club, nor to forum attendees. Both are very active citizens and volunteers in the community of Omaha Council Bluffs and are prolific writers. Betty Deneen Schreier brings a background of teaching in elementary and secondary schools, followed by a career in banking and marketing. An Omaha native, Betty is a graduate of Holy Name High School and has a BA in English from Duchesne College. William E. Ramsey is a Council Bluffs native and a graduate of St. Francis, now St. Albert High School. He holds a degree in journalism from Creighton University, and Bill's early career includes a stint in TV news as a reporter and photographer at Channel 6, followed by work as a public relations director for several organizations, including Creighton and Boys Town. A veteran of combat with the Marines in the Korean War, Bill's more recent years have been a bit more placid as co-operator with wife Pat of their own public relations and advertising agency. Betty and Bill have collaborated on numerous articles and booklets, plus several books. These have included a biography of the late Archbishop Daniel E. Sheehan, A Gentle Shepherd, and Silent Hills Speak, A History of Council Bluffs. Their latest book brings a fascinating and inspiring story of a Grand Island businessman and his efforts to bring safety to safety countless fellow German Jews during the nightmarish terror of Nazism. So please welcome Betty Deneen Schreier and Bill Ramsey and their book, Doorway to Freedom, The Story of David Kaufman, Merchant, Benefactor, Rescuer.
Good afternoon, President Wills, Gary Wills from the Press Club, the Board of Directors. We thank you for inviting us today. Thank Dale for the rather short introduction, but a very good one. And we gave you a lot more material. We did. Yeah, that's right. We thank each of you particularly for being here today. I know there were all kinds of obstacles thrown in your path, and you got here anyway. And ever since they had that darn pedestrian bridge downtown, people are parking everywhere. So. Just met all kinds of crowds. But other than that, we're happy to have you here today and thrilled to have you here today. This is our third book signing at the Press Club. As Dale mentioned, we had the book on Archbishop Sheehan, Gentle Shepherd, and also Silent Hill Speak. And we had nice crowds as we have here today, and we thank all of you. There's so many people I'd like to thank personally, but I better not do that at this moment. Following the Council Bluffs history book that we published in 2002, we accepted a new challenge in 2004 to write a book concerning the tragic period of the Holocaust that took more than 11 million lives during the 1930s and 1940s. Silent Hill Speak took approximately 2 years to write, and Doorway to Freedom required almost 4 years to research, interview family members living in various cities and throughout the country, and to write out our first draft and then to search for a publisher. They didn't tell us about that part of it in the Journalism 101, which was taught, incidentally, by someone's wife is here today. Harry Dolphin was my main journalism teacher at Creighton University, and I always think of Harry because he started me on the writing road, and I don't know that I ever would have made it to this point without his early counseling and great teaching. And thanks, Gene, for being here today. Our publisher is Mosaic Press, Ontario, Canada, an imprint of Judaica Press in New York, Brooklyn, New York. And our publisher, Howard Astor, said he saw this book as an educational resource. We've heard that from a number of people, and we feel good about that because we wanted this to be something that would be used in schools, middle school on through college, and also for adult education as well. We are particularly indebted to the Ted and Sarah Selden Family Fund. And Ted is here today, and we thank Ted Selden and Sarah for your help with this book, Ted. And Nebraska Jewish Historical Society for being co-publishers along with Mosaic Press. With their generous assistance, we were able to bring David Kaufman's life and his cherished Jewish values to our readers. I'd also like to introduce, mention another tremendous vehicle that just was previewed last night at the film streams downtown called Refusnik. And the producer of that program, I call it a video epic. I said it was a documentary, but it's far beyond that. And Stephanie Selden Howard is here today, the producer. I'd like to have Stephanie stand. This is going to be known very widely soon. It's a tremendous film. Stephanie, please stand. It ties so beautifully into our own book because there were 1.5 million Jews locked in Russia being persecuted after World War II, or before that too, but after World War II. A tremendous story about their plight and their heroic rescue. We also would like to, as you'll see on the back cover of our book, a portion of the proceeds from this book will go to Holocaust education. I want to thank my wife, Pat, who's been counseling me, encouraging me, bawling me out sometimes for being late coming home, working weekends and nights, but the book did get finished, and I thank her for that. I thank our artist, Becky Enholm, who laid the book out, has done so many good things for us over the years, and our editor, Dave Haberman, the retired chairman of the journalism department at Creighton University, who edited this book and did such a marvelous job, and his wife, Joan, is with him today. Also, other people I'd like to thank. Bob Cote, of course, from KIOS for doing this book as well, doing the taping today of our talk. And so now I'd like to have the better half and the much younger half of our duo, Betty Schreier.
Thank you, Bill. Dr. Ben Nachman, a retired dentist in Omaha, has pursued Holocaust research for more than 30 years. When you read the introduction of this book, you will learn how he discovered David Kaufman during his research. He then consulted with other Holocaust researchers throughout the entire country, and he discovered that Kaufman's individual rescue efforts were unmatched by any others. In April of 2004, Dr. Nachman contacted us to ask us to write a book about Kaufman, and in our 10 years as co-authors, we concluded that this story is going to be a highlight in our writing careers. We're delighted to be with you this afternoon to celebrate the life of a man that we have come to know, respect, and love. Noted author, historian, and Pulitzer Prize recipient Doris Kearns Goodwin has written about many famous Americans, and she once said, "I just want them to come alive again. That's all you really ask of history." We hope that David Kaufman will come alive again for you in the pages of Doorway to Freedom. The book begins with this dedication: to David Kaufman, a German Jewish immigrant, and to all those who reached out to rescue thousands of families, friends, and strangers from the darkness of Nazi tyranny and the diabolic genocide of the Holocaust.
In part one of the book, you will read about David's birth in Germany, his school days, time served in the German army, and early business career. This continues with his coming to America in 1903. Samuel Walbach, on a buying trip from Grand Island to New York in 1904, saw David waiting on customers at the Abram Strauss or A&S department store in Brooklyn. Walbach invited him to work at his department store in Grand Island. He encouraged David by assuring him that he would make him a floor walker and a window trimmer. What a great way to lure him to Grand Island. And he would pay his expenses to go out to Grand Island. Several decades later, residents would learn that David did not like Grand Island when he first arrived. He was dismayed at the lack of pavement, the all-too-frequent dust storms, the unimposing buildings. Then he reflected after a short stay. "There was something about the old town that made me like it. There were no big buildings, but that doesn't make a town. It's the people who live in a place that make you love it. And there was something about those old-timers and the ones who came after that made me like Grand Island. There was something about the businessmen and women and the people of Grand Island their willingness to cooperate in all worthwhile undertakings. That makes it a pleasure to work with them. Most of us have more good thoughts than we have bad ones, and all we have to do is to follow up on the good thoughts. The handicap is that often good thoughts are not followed up by required action, and isn't that so true? In 1906, David, along with partners Wernert and O'Connor, who had been in the boarding house with him in Grand Island, opened Kaufman's 5 and 10 cent store at 218 West 3rd Street, downtown Grand Island. In 1924, David moved his store to the permanent location at 308 West 3rd Street, where it continued to enjoy a status not only as a shopper's haven, but also it was a place where David, as he closed the store each evening, many of these stories came to light from various sources. He collected food and clothing from the store and other departments in the store, and he placed these items in a box on the loading dock at the back of the store, where the poor and the hungry came to depend on his generosity through the years. And just as a quick sidebar, JEO Architecture and Engineering firm called us last April and asked if we would be the speakers in Grand Island when they rededicated the Kaufman store as the Kaufman Office Center. And we were shocked to be the speakers at this. We thought that probably the mayor, the governor, somebody. No, they wanted us. So down we went to Grand Island. We've been there 20 times over the last 4 years. It's a nice, nice ride down the highway there. We know every mile of it. And at any rate, in the middle of the street, they had the dedication. And there we were as the speakers at the dedication of the Kaufman Office Center. Bill Rutlinger was Kaufman's store manager, and he said of him, "We never had a contract between us and never had a crossword between us either. I think he was one of the finest men that God ever created." The remainder of this section tells of David's marriage, establishing stores in Kearney and North Platte, his banking career, his ownership of the Grand Movie Theater next door to his business, his active participation in the Liederkranz Society, Hall County Historical Society, Red Cross, Salvation Army, St. Francis Hospital, Chamber of Commerce, Self-Help Society, and numerous others. Following his first wife's death, Kaufman married Harry Schilder's widow, Madeline. Their long association with Wally and Beta Kemp is featured in this, and a very important part of the book. David's final illness and death, and the lasting legacy established by Madeline, the Kaufman Cummings Trust Foundation now, continues to benefit many in Hall County to this day. And they also made a grant for our book to be provided to all the schools and libraries in Hall County, some 600 books.
Part two of the book traces the origin of the tragedy we call the Holocaust and why it became necessary for Kaufman to rescue families from the tyrannical laws against Jews initiated by Adolf Hitler and the consequences of this dictator's actions throughout Europe in the 1930s and the 1940s. Many of you have seen this inscription on the memorial wall located at the Jewish Community Center in Omaha. The partial menorah is symbolic of the 6 million Jews who perished. And this is what it says on the memorial wall. "That tragic era in our history when light was obscured by darkness, righteousness succumbed to cruelty. 6 million, one-third of our people, victims of the blind hatred of one madman's brutality, were sent to their death in the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Dachau, Treblinka, and Buchenwald, and other death camps. Their memory must remain forever etched into the conscience of all mankind. Neither time nor distance shall cause memory to dim." During the 1936 Olympics, to the dismay of Hitler and the Nazis, a young black American, Jesse Owens, would steal the headlines and the hearts of throngs that witnessed his heroics and those of his teammates. Hitler's dream of proving the superiority of Aryans was shattered by Owens' stunning talent. His tenacity and God-given skills earned him 4 gold medals, making him the first American to achieve that honor in the history of Olympic track and field competition. He set world records in 3 of his 4 competitive events. He participated in the 100-meter dash, the 200-meter dash, the 400-meter relay, and the broad jump. Reports circulated that Hitler who was on hand for most of the competitions, refused to extend congratulations to the American Star and his black teammates. He was angered that the American Star stole international headlines. Another event was Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass. It was a pivotal event in the move to crush the Jewish presence in Germany, and it occurred on November 9, 1938, a night that would be seared into the memories of Germans and Jews alike. The devastating incident illustrated the merciless strategy of the Nazi movement. It created a night of terror and destruction, sending the clear message that Jews would no longer be tolerated in the Third Reich. For a world still not fully comprehending the shadow of death and destruction spreading across Germany and eventually across all Europe, Kristallnacht shattered not only glass, but also long-cherished hopes for the restoration of decency and fairness in Germany. Headlines in newspapers around the globe shouted what should have been realized much earlier. And we have a headline from the Chicago Tribune of 1938. "Jews fleeing Hitler terror," read the banner headline of the Chicago Daily Tribune on November 11, 1938, ironically, the 20th anniversary of the armistice ending World War I.
With the departure from Hamburg, Germany, the luxury liner St. Louis had 8 decks and accommodations for 400 first class and 500 tourist class passengers. Still in shock from the Kristallnacht devastation, Germany's Jews learned that a special voyage to Havana, Cuba, had been announced by the shipping line for a May 13, 1939 departure. The 937 tickets were sold out in record time. Most of the buyers were Jews. To leave family and friends behind in order to flee Nazi oppression must have been a heart-wrenching decision. On top of that, the Third Reich, with controlling interest in the shipping line by 1939, systematically dispossessed the travelers of property, their homes, their businesses, and allowed them to depart with only 10 Reichmarks, approximately $4. U.S. Consul Harold Tuell, in a confidential report to the State Department, noted that with 2,500 Jews, refugees already in Cuba, and anti-Jewish and anti-refugee feelings running high, at that time, in response, the Cuban president invalidated the St. Louis passengers' landing permits even before the ship had left Hamburg. Only 28 of the 937 passengers were allowed to disembark in Havana. Despite feverish negotiations, the ship was finally forced to leave after anchoring in the harbor some 7 days in the sweltering heat. The United States also denied them entrance as the ship went up the East Coast. In the movie The Voyage of the Damned in 1976, which is a classic film, and was starring Orson Welles and many other top stars of the day, we witnessed the U.S. Coast Guard commanding a ship coming toward the St. Louis as it was heading into Florida in hopes of landing there. And the captain of the ship said, "Oh, good, they're welcoming us." But the sign from the ship said, "You can't come in here, you can't dock here." So they went back to Germany, back to the European continent, and they landed at Antwerp, Belgium, one of several European countries that agreed to allow a certain number of Jewish refugees to enter. But most of them did not enter there, nor were they adopted by some people in England. Most of them perished in the concentration camps. This editorial, the last of an editorial in the New York Times, stated it this way: "We can only hope some hearts will soften and some refuge will be found. The cruise of the St. Louis cries to high heaven of man's inhumanity to man." And a very small, but I think very beautiful piece of courage comes through here in this brief paragraph. King Christian X of Denmark, an inspirational incident that typified the fighting spirit of so many oppressed peoples and nations during the Nazi reign of terror, involved King Christian of Denmark. The king had ordered a Danish official to raise the nation's flag. Germany had occupied the country, but wasn't quite as oppressive as in some other countries, but it was occupied and certainly under their control. A Gestapo officer told the young man, told the king, the man would be shot if he carried out the king's order to put up the flag. King Christian immediately responded, "Very well, I will put the flag up myself. And he walked out in full view of the German soldiers, and he did it without further incident. One other quick piece, I won't go into this, but it's a marvelous story, and many books about this, about the Danish government and the people of Denmark, again, occupied and saving more than 7,000 Jews by taking them at night by small boat across a 25-mile strait, pretty much like the English Channel, across to Sweden, which was a neutral country during World War II. And the book that I encourage you to get as fast as you can and read it, it's a marvelous book and inspirational. It's called Boats in the Night.
One of the personal stories that we feature in the book is by Sam and Magda Fried. And they were both prisoners in camps during the war. And Magda Fried died in 1985, but not before she had left a touching and inspiring record of her experiences during the darkest days of the Nazi rule. And these are just a few excerpts from her notebook. "Many years have gone by, and I have cried less than I have this past year. Why have I allowed myself to feel so sensitized that I can begin to recall and remember the scenes of the past that were flooding my brain? Why should my heart be breaking and tears washing down my face when I read the ad for travel to beautiful Czechoslovakia? Why do I wish I could go for a visit and see and walk where I was born, where I was a child, where I played and went to school? I was nurtured and disciplined, instructed and corrected, where I knew many families and where everyone knew our family many generations back. It causes me pain knowing that if I should go for a visit, I would be a total stranger. There is no one from my family there, only graves from a previous generation. And who would know if any remain? The pain would be unbearable. And yet, like the salmon that returns to its place of origin at the peril to its life, so do I yearn to be able to go home. And yet, what home? Am I so unique in feeling the need once more to go home? Somehow it will always be my home whenever I refer to the past. Why is there no grave I can go to and cry when I ache? Mother, where are you? I'm beginning to go back and wandering so much. How did you die? Did they notice that you were a young mother of only 40 years old with a little girl who was just 10 years old? A young mother that did everything for her children and family. A young woman that did not have a chance to enjoy the good things that life has to offer. Like my youngest sister, Shanu, as if she never existed. How tragic! The only thing I remember about her is that she was born in July or August of 1933. She had brown eyes and very light brown hair, almost blonde hair. And she was pretty, and the baby of our family. My heart is breaking when I think she was a little girl of 10 and had not done any harm to anybody, and her life snuffed out without knowing why. Now tears are rolling down my face. I wonder, why have we been so forgiving? All these years, it never occurred to me to carry hatred or seek revenge."
I'd like now to introduce Sam and Frances Fried. I don't believe they could make it here today, but they've helped a good deal with the book as well. Sam is a survivor of Auschwitz. He married Frances after Magda's death, and he and Frances have started an endowment to promote Holocaust education in colleges, universities across Nebraska, much the same as the Institute for Holocaust Education has done for middle schools and high schools, and that organization is at the Jewish Community Center, headed by Ted's young daughter, Beth Selden Dotan. When Sam Fried is invited to share his experiences with community groups or students in middle and secondary schools throughout Nebraska, he begins by describing his family life, his birthplace, former Republic of Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia was one of the world's 10 most industrialized countries in those days. My parents had very little had me very late in life, and because I was the youngest child, I was often treated like a grandchild. I went to elementary school where I was treated as all the other children were, and I had many non-Jewish friends. Attending school turned into a daily anguish after the Vienna arbitration of 1938, more rules and regulations against the Jews. After the Hungarians took over our region, our lives changed dramatically. In classrooms, Jewish children were being shamed and were discriminated against every day. Jews of military age were taken to work camps, to the war front later when the Russian army was advancing. They were transported to Auschwitz. I remember hearing adults talk about Jews being burned in parts of Europe. It seemed that it was happening far away, maybe on another planet. My family believed that because we had lived there for so many generations, no one would hurt us. And after all, these were our neighbors and our friends. On Sunday morning, 1944, a few days after Passover, I was riding my bicycle when the local pharmacist asked me to go to the neighboring town to check to see if anything was happening to the Jews there. When I got there, I saw the police and SS troops gathering Jews. A policeman from our town, a friend of the family, recognized me and told me to get out of there quickly. He said that on Wednesday they were coming to gather Jews in our town. I told the pharmacist back in my town what I had heard and seen. I was told not to worry. I stopped at every Jewish house on the way to my home, and they all repeated the same words, "We don't have to worry." When I told my mother, she told me not to worry. When I told a Gentile friend of mine what I had heard, he advised me to take his ID papers and run away. I took him up on his offer and planned to join my brother, who lived 150 miles away under false identity. 2 days after leaving home, I had second thoughts. Maybe they are right, and it would not happen to us. When I returned home, I initially hid outside my home to see if the policeman's warning was true. The following morning, I saw the SS and the local police had my family, and they were rounded them up with other town people in the town square. Then I realized I would not be able to escape. I threw my papers out and turned myself in. In a few hours, we were all taken to a brick factory where we were to spend several weeks in misery. We had no access to the outside world and little or no food or water, and we lived among rats. I don't know how we managed to survive. Several weeks passed, and we were to learn that orders were given during a meeting held at the police headquarters where officers representing Nazi Germany gave orders that were to be taken immediately from the original Nazi document. It stated Jews will be transported in 110 trains to the station at Kassa, where the transports will be taken over by the German police. Each train will transport 3,000 persons. It will consist of 45 cars, each with 70 persons with little baggage, and two C cars, front and back, for the guards. The Jews will be able to take along only limited luggage. The camp, ghetto, and road to the trains are to be under strict guard. The road is to be closed to traffic while the Jews are marched. They are to be marched in groups of 500, walking four in a row. The number of persons in a filled car will be marked with chalk on the outside of that car. Each car, one person will be selected as a council member and will be in charge of acquisition of water, what little there was. Other persons would also help with the food, and that was 2 days' supply of bread per person, and they were on the train longer. Each car will be provided with a covered bucket for sanitary purposes and with one can for all those people for drinking water. If necessary, as many as 100 may be pushed into these cars like sardines. Those that couldn't get in or survive would perish. I was on that train. We were confined in a cattle car, standing room only, for several days. On the second day, the train slowed down while we were crossing the mountains. When I tried to jump up out through an opening, I was told not to do this because the guards would kill everybody on the train.
Sam said, "Some time ago, a high school student asked me this question. If you could write a letter to your parents, what would you tell them?" So Sam wrote this heartfelt message. "Dear Mom and Dad, it is 60 years since the Allied soldiers, after a long, hard battle and many casualties, defeated Nazi Germany. And the memories of Auschwitz have never left me. I lost you at a very young age, and there are no graves for me to visit. Mom, I will never forget the last time I saw you. With tears in your eyes, you told me to save myself and to tell them I could work very hard. There was no time to say goodbye. 24 hours after we saw each other, we heard the following comments from other inmates. You see the smoke? That's what's left of your parents. I cried until there were no more tears. Then I remembered what you told me. You must save yourself. From that day on, death stared at me constantly. I lived from second to second, but somehow I escaped death. The Holocaust was an unforgivable, dehumanizing experience, but we survivors of the Holocaust steadfastly refused to let it become the essential life force that shaped our lives. I fought each and every day to stay alive. I refused to give up hope. I battled constantly not to become a hostage of yesterday. Dad, here I am a half century later, and every day I think of the lesson that I learned from you. Life is not only a gift, it is our responsibility to do something with that life. Your loving son, Sam.
Most in this audience are familiar with the Diary of Anne Frank. Her father, Otto Frank, wrote this after the tragedy that befell their family for those years. We cannot change what happened during the Holocaust. The only thing we can do is to learn from the past and realize what discrimination and persecution of innocent people means. I believe that it's everyone's responsibility to fight prejudice. Elie Wiesel, in the Night Trilogy, Elie Wiesel was also a survivor and a tremendous spokesman for the Jewish cause in the Holocaust and an outstanding writer and a Nobel Prize-winning person, writer. Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed. Never shall I forget the smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Part three of the book has stories about what happened to those rescued family members when they came to America and adapted to a new life, language, unfamiliar customs, and places of employment. We discovered a common thread of gratitude all the time through all of our chapters. Izzy and Fayo Khan were the first two to reach America's shores, and they settled in Grand Island. Before their departure from Germany, they had experienced the severe restrictions imposed on the Jewish citizens in their personal and professional lives. In his previous visits to Germany, David Kaufman had told Fayo and other members, family members and people there, if you ever want to come to America, just let me know. Here are a few opening paragraphs about Izzy and Fayo Khan. In the middle of the night, someone hurled a rock at the house. It crashed through their bedroom window, shattering the glass, sending jagged and menacing shards in every direction. The threatening action found its mark. Their hearts were frozen in fear. The hopes and dreams of the newly married couple seemed fragile as the shattered panes of glass. This was their wedding night. Izzy and Fayo Khan were married December 26, 1929, in Ock, a small town in western Germany. Dorothy Kahn Resnick, a daughter, also remembered that her mother, Fayo, had urged her husband to leave Germany several times, but he said again, like everyone else, we will not be hurt, we will be safe here. He thought that surely that this would not happen there. She continued to ask him to leave, and finally said that she was going to go to America because she was so frightened. He finally decided definitely they would be going together. This is a check for $50. It's a little hard to see into the light here. It's an original check, $50. It's in our book, a picture of this. The check was waiting for the families as they arrived at Ellis Island, and each family got a check for $50. And we thought, gee, that's really nice, but $50, that really wouldn't be very much for a family or for people. And we found out in looking for the book of the dollar value that it would be about $1,100 in that day. So that was indeed a very generous gift to leave each family. Izzy Khan was so proud he didn't want to cash that check and gave it to his daughter, and she's kept it all these years.
Teresa Khan Stiss is another rescued relative, and she said she regrets she has no memories of David Kaufman. Because they lived in Omaha and their lives are filled with the challenges of family life in a new land, their opportunities to connect with Kaufman were limited. That does not lessen her appreciation for what he did for so many, however. Therese said her children are fascinated by the story of how she and her family came to America under his sponsorship. Though she can't recall the name of the ship that carried them to New York, nor the details of their arrival and eventually settling down in Omaha, her joy in being an American and living in a land of freedom never fades as she reflects that the goodness of one man made all the difference. Carol Marks Plonchek said, "I don't think we thanked him enough, now that I'm looking back on it." And her cousin, Alan Hecht, said they remain grateful to Kaufman for his generosity and encouragement in helping their family begin a new life during a time of terror in the German homeland. Alan terms Kaufman a man of valor for his rescue of so many families. When he learned of David and Madeline's contributions to the Grand Island community, he said, "Not only was he philanthropic, but he also had a heart because he brought a lot of people to this country." Dr. Ginter Kahn was a little boy when he was rescued, and he wrote the epilogue in our book. "As a young man, I met David on several occasions, but I cannot recall that I ever thanked him for what he did for my family or for me. Perhaps in a small way, this epilogue will make up for my failure. David Kaufman will live forever in the minds of the people who read this book. Because of the efforts of Ben Nachman, Betty Schreier, and Bill Ramsey, this book will pay tribute to his memory so that the world will know and remember the goodness and mercy that was imbued in his being. When I lecture throughout the world, no one ever believes there were thousands of concentration camps. We, these families and I, were saved from them by Fayo Khan and David Kaufman. May it never be forgotten."
We begin our afterword with a quote from George Bernard Shaw. "Life is not a brief candle. It is a splendid torch that I want to make burn as brightly as possible for future generations." And that's what he did for these people who surely would have been killed in the Holocaust. In its list of masculine first names, the dictionary has only one word to interpret the meaning of David: beloved. A legacy of living with purpose shaped the life of David Kaufman. Community leaders viewed this man as a highly respected role model in the worlds of business and philanthropy. Few of his colleagues knew him as the hero he became to the rescued relatives and other people among the Jewish population in Europe. With a courageous and compassionate stroke of the pen, David Kaufman opened wide the doorway to freedom. His signature on more than 80 affidavits of support assured their freedom to live in Goldin Medin, which is Yiddish expression for America, the Golden Land. Now they enjoy ever-increasing numbers as the third generation of survivors of Hitler's Holocaust thrives among us today. David's compassion, kindness, and thoughtfulness were outward expressions of an enduring love of family and his adopted country. He gratefully witnessed the growth of the Kaufman family as children were born and raised in this new land of freedom and opportunity for all people. Each person worked to earn enough to avoid becoming dependent upon Uncle David, although he kept in touch with him and often sent them anniversary gifts, birthday gifts, and they were definitely still in touch. And he was lovingly called Uncle David by all. All agreed that he had lived up to the meaning of his name, beloved.
In 1994, Pope John Paul II said, "To this day, Auschwitz does not cease to admonish, reminding us that anti-Semitism is a great sin against humanity, that all racial hatred leads to the trampling of human dignity. In this first decade of the 21st century, we continue to witness injustice, discrimination, and genocide. Those who value freedom remain vigilant in recognizing the efforts of all those who have gone before us. We honor David Kaufman and all those whose courageous actions helped to sustain life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We will never forget the gallant rescuers who led the persecuted from the darkness of the Holocaust through a doorway to freedom."
Finally, in our talk, Rabbi Meyer Kripke officiated at David Kaufman's funeral in Grand Island, August 1969. David was 93. He wrote the prologue of this book in which he talked about the principles that guided this man's goodness to so many. family, friends, and strangers too. David understood wealth is held only in stewardship, and that his cherished Jewish values led him to look upon the poor in every circumstance. It is an honor for us to bring David Kaufman's life alive into the pages of our book. We are indebted to so many individuals and families. That's why our acknowledgments are 5 pages long and single-spaced. And I don't think we forgot anybody, but it was definitely a team effort to do this. We thank you for your attention today, for being here, getting through all the obstacles downtown Omaha, and toughing it out to be with us. And thank you again for your attention and for the belief that David Kaufman's life remains a blessing even to this day for all of us. We have some books here that Betty and I have written, books and booklets that you might look at afterwards. But now I think Dale will ask for some questions, perhaps.
I will indeed. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill and Betty. Thank you very much. You may give them a round now and a round later. They'll be seated during our Q&A session here. And again, I urge you, encourage you to write your questions out, and Gary over here will be picking them up and bring them up to me. We have a couple of them so far, and one says, how did Mr. Kaufman arrange for the rescue of these families? What were the mechanics of his rescuing these families?
He had to sign an affidavit of support, which proved to the government and the country that these families would not be a burden financially or emotionally or any way to the country, the county, or the state in which they took up residence. The affidavit of support required his signature, notarized, and David took a big risk, because if these families didn't earn their own living after they got here, then he was totally responsible, even for the education of the minor children. So it was indeed a truly big undertaking for him. And each family, sometimes there were 6 in the family. In this one affidavit, there are 2 twin boys who were 6 years old, a 2-year-old sister, 80-year-old grandfather, and the mother and the father, who were each about 40 at that time.
That affidavit was filed with whom then? With what agency?
It was filed with the government and with the shipping lines, so that they knew that these people had a place to go when they returned.
Mm-hmm. Getting back again to the mechanics of him finding people, was it word of mouth? These weren't all relatives of his. Some were, but not all, right?
Yeah. The mechanics, the important part was that Fayo, the first one to come over, she would go to the dime store and say, David, you know, so-and-so needs to come over. Would you write an affidavit of support for them? And so then he would start the process all over and write another affidavit. And then she'd go to him again a week or so later and say, you know, this family needs to come over. Would you write an affidavit? So he would do that. And we know that we didn't catch all the families. You'll see the Tree of Life up here with their names on it. They had that done by an artist for David's 85th birthday to thank him for bringing them over. But the names of the families that he brought over are on here. And when we talked with a couple of the rescued men in California, we said, well, your names aren't on here, Ernest and Ernie Levy. And they said, no, we didn't know about it. And I said, well, when did you come over? And he said, well, it was 1948. And I said, yeah, but the war was long over by then. And he said, well, we were in Auschwitz, and we've been recuperating. And David said he'd bring you over any time you wanted to come. So they knew that. And because he had frequently visited Germany while he was being successful here in America, he would go over to see family.
Another question, I'd like to hear more specific behaviors of what the Grand Island Man did. And I'm not sure if they're referring to the help that he gave to immigrants coming over from Germany, or if along the business line, because he was a very successful businessman in Grand Island. Perhaps you could address that as well.
You might want to make a couple shots.
He was generous to everybody who was in need, and he even gave a building to the Salvation Army so that they could conduct their services. And he and his first wife helped to start the self-help society during the Depression, so people could earn credits for what they did, and then with those credits they could buy food and clothing and things they needed for their children. He was a big player in the American Red Cross during World War I and World War II, and with the Hall County Historical Society, he, in the minutes that we read from their original minutes, it said that he was the one that initiated that they apply for 501c3 status or nonprofit status so that the Historical Society could continue on.
Also mentioned his generosity again on the holidays, mainly Thanksgiving and Christmas. David went to several restaurants in the community and told the owners to please serve any homeless or hungry person a meal that evening, and he would come by in the morning and take care of that. And that went on for a number of years. That was kind of the unsung hero, the hidden hero. And no one really knew much about that until people were telling us along the way. Also, he kept the Jewish synagogue, not the synagogue, but the Jewish tradition alive in that city. There was no synagogue, but he taught young children and also had a part of the Salvation Army building that they would meet in. And so it was he never let his Jewish values leave him, even though he was somewhat distant from. He did go to the synagogue in Lincoln and in Omaha from time to time.
In reading the book, I found out that he was a mentor also to many fledgling businessmen. And in fact, one of them started a store in Omaha, Harold Mangelson. And are there any Mangelson people here today?
Right back there.
There they are, right there. Yay. Yes, fantastic. That's great.
Well, we heard that Mangelson's in the early days, that there was a huge portrait of David Kaufman hanging on the wall in Mangelson's store. And in the book, you'll read that Harold Mangelson followed all the principles of marketing and merchandising and wanted to model his store after David Kaufman's. And he certainly did a wonderful job because it's thriving there today. And so we are very pleased that we have that connection to Grand Island.
And we thank you for coming and being such an enthusiastic part of our meeting here today. Mm-hmm. Another thing, go ahead, you may have some other questions.
Well, where's Lowen? Would
Cruz,
you come up, sir? You have a story about Mr. Kaufman. Would you share
it with us? I don't think I'd give him the microphone if I were you.
Bill and I can tell stories on each other, and we promise we won't.
Okay, thanks.
I knew Mr. Kaufman and visited with him many times as a child. I would go with my father or grandfather. My grandfather was the same age as he. I couldn't get into the conversation very much because it was all chatter in German. They were so glad to see each other. But I remember, it's fun to hear you say Uncle David. I asked my father one time, what's his first name? And Dad said, to you, he's Mr. Kaufman. He was totally respected. And, you know, these are new stories and it's wonderful. We didn't know about that, of course. But a few years after the war, Mr. Kaufman raised the wages of all of his clerks 10 cents an hour. The Grand Island Chamber of Commerce was in a state of shock. They just went berserk, and they made it public, their objection to ruination of the economy of Grand Island by this fellow out there.
Like a fringe benefit.
I heard about it from my folks, of course, who were very pleased, and they reported later that Mr. Kaufman responded publicly in a way that we would understand in terms of his generosity. He said, they're the ones that helped me make my money. Why wouldn't I want to share it with them?
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I have a note here. It says, it's not a question, an addition to the comments. Following the lead of the Orthodox Church, the Bulgarian government refused to let the Nazis export, it says, any of the 45,000 Jews, even though Bulgaria was a Nazi ally. So the Bulgarian government apparently stood up to the to the Nazi regime at
indeed.
That time.
Many rescuers involved.
I'd like to get into the mechanics of your writing. Yes, you see, it took some 4 years of research, at least.
Well, we're pretty slow writers, actually, obviously.
And reading the book, I think I could determine, now, either Betty wrote this section or Bill wrote this section, but I'm not sure which. Did you write by chapter? Did you write by paragraph? Tell us something about the mechanics.
Okay. Betty's a teacher. She can do that better than I.
Well, Bill still likes to use his electric typewriter. And and I like to use a computer. And so Bill would work at his office or his home, and he would take a chapter, and then I would work at the computer at my home and work on a chapter. And then we would get together at his office or someplace and take the chapters apart. And then we'd try to put them back together again. And then in the end, though, Dave Haberman, our editor, was the one who really made sense of those paragraphs. But we asked other people their opinions, and we liked to quote them, and we did a lot of research. You know, even though I lived through those war years in World War II, and before that, I didn't really know all that was going on. So we depended on a lot of good writers and good historians for the research that we did. But getting back to one of the questions, too, you know, the people in Grand Island had no clue that David was rescuing these people. A few of the Jewish people may have known, because in an interview we heard from Bernie Greenberger, he was saying, well, I think he rescued some Jewish families, maybe 100 people. And his wife piped up in the background. She said, oh, no, more like 200. And so he was. It came as news to the people in Grand Island that he had rescued all these families because they lived in other states throughout the country. He gave them that option to settle wherever they wanted to. And the family members were shocked when they found out that David Kaufman was such a huge community player. They didn't know that he helped the Red Cross. And even the Sisters of St. Francis, when they needed to expand their hospital and get a new school of nursing, David was right there leading the drive. He was a chairman for their fund drive. So, you know, it didn't make any difference. Anyone's race or ethnicity or their religious beliefs made no difference to him. He was a champion for any worthy cause that came along.
Other answer to the nuts and bolts of how it was put together, first thing you want to do writing a book, or we normally have done this, is to get a good title, or at least a working title. And we did that pretty early on. We decided that we would be using light as one of our light and darkness as our symbols. So the book was going to be, was a working title for about 3 years, 2 years. Out of Darkness was the name of it. And we had the chapters of the three divisions that we just went through with you. We had Man of Vision, which was David Kaufman's life pretty much. The middle part was A Darkening World. That was a mini-history of World War II and the Holocaust period. And a Dawn of Rescue, that was the last part of the book. So we kept with that for some time until we gave a talk on Holocaust Commemoration Sunday at the Capitol Building. We were asked to do that, which stunned us again, but we did go there and do that. And as we read our own words in this little talk, one of the lines was, and it was here today as well, with a stroke of a pen, David Kaufman opened the doorway to freedom. And as we drove back from Lincoln, we said, you know, maybe we ought to consider another title that's more positive. And we tried this on, including the publisher, said, oh, that's the title. That's your title. And back to another piece that's kind of interesting about employees that Senator Cruz was talking about. He not only raised their salary 10 cents, but he also was one of the first stores to offer employee benefits and the first store in Nebraska to have air conditioning. So a lot of people were grumbling about him, as a matter of fact, leading the way.
Probably 30 to 40 cents they increased, so it wasn't 25.
Absolutely, yes. Getting back to your research again, did you determine, okay, I'm going to research this area and I'm going to research this area, or did you do joint research? Or tell us some of those details, if you may.
I think on the on his life, we did together pretty much all the trips to Grand Island, to the Hall County Courthouse, to various people that we interviewed, the library. Grand Island Independent was tremendous help to us. And Stir Museum, also we had a book signing in the Stir Museum not long ago, tremendous help to us. So we did those together. The middle part, because I'm military-minded and read a lot about World War II and lived through it as well as a young person, pretty much did a lot of that. But we even worked on some of those together, some of those chapters, like the St. Louis and some individual little anecdotes or sidebars. And the last part we did totally together because we were doing the interviews via the phone largely or in person sometimes and worked those out through a transcription. We taped them all, and then we got our information off of that. So we did that pretty much together.
Betty, did you have a comment?
Well, yes. I think a pivotal event for us was Dr. Nachman invited us to meet Dr. Jonathan Sarna when he was at the Jewish Community Center to talk about his book of 350 years of Jewish people in America. And he said, you know, he said that he would meet with you that afternoon if you want to talk with him about this Kaufman book. And we said, oh, my goodness, he's a noted scholar from Brandeis University, and he's just finished his huge book. But we jumped at the chance, and we had a preliminary outline of what we wanted to cover, David's early life and then the Holocaust. And when we went through this outline with him, he said, yes, you must include what happened in Europe. And he was very, very affirming. And he even went to the point where he wrote a comment on the back of our book. He says, he who saves a single life, the Talmud declares, it is as though he saved an entire universe. David Kaufman saved hundreds of lives. In an era when so many others sought to bar German Jews from America's shores, he worked behind the scenes generously, courageously, and tirelessly to provide what those refugees needed to enter the country. Doorway to Freedom recounts this uplifting story. It reminds us that the Hitler era, for all of its horrors, also produced unexpected heroes. David Kaufman was one of them.
And David Hendy of the World Herald did the first story about this. Would have been in 2004, I think, wasn't it, Betty, or 5?
Well, 2005. New Year's Day.
New Year's Day, 2005. The headline, part of the headline was, Schindler had a list, David Kaufman had a heart. And I thought that was quite an amazing piece as well. Beautiful story that appeared. We thought it would be somewhere in the paper, but we looked all through the paper from the back going forward, and it was on the front page, a lead story on New Year's Day. And so that was a wonderful surprise. We also have statements on here from Sam Fried, the Auschwitz survivor, and the World Herald and the Grand Island Independent did endorsements on the back of the book, which was really a nice thing for us as well.
But I might add that you can get it and find out these details only by reading the book, which I have. It's a most enlightening book, and we want to thank both of you so very much for coming and sharing with us today.
Thank you so
Betty
much.
Schreier and Bill Ramsey, thank you for Doorway to Freedom, the story of David Kaufman.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Our guest speakers have been William E. Ramsey and Betty Deneen Schreier, authors of Doorway to Freedom, the story of David Kaufman. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 18, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next two forums will be two debates leading up to the November general election. On Thursday, October 16th, there will be a debate between the two candidates for Congress from Nebraska's 2nd District, incumbent Republican Lee Terry, and Democrat challenger Jim Esch. The following week, on Wednesday, October 22nd, you can hear a debate on the proposed constitutional amendment banning affirmative action in Nebraska. The participants will be Ward Connerly from the Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative and David Kramer from Nebraskans United. If you'd like to attend these or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.